From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, public radio veteran Margaret Lowe will be the new leader of WBUR.
I think it is the job of jobs.
Also today, Boston's Black Radical, the story of William Monroe Trotter in his newspaper, The Guardian.
He succeeded in the sense that telling and inspiring African-American community to decide for themselves what their politics is going to be.
And 100 years ago, turkeys were almost extinct. Has their comeback been too successful?
They are showing up in places like Boston, and as they do, they start adapting to people, and turkeys are aggressive birds.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Margaret Lowe will be the new general manager and CEO of WBUR. Lowe, a veteran public radio journalist, is currently president of Atlantic Live and senior vice president of The Atlantic. WBUR announced today that she'll take up her post at the station in January. Prior to joining The Atlantic, Lowe spent over three decades at National Public Radio, culminating in her role as senior vice president of news there. Here's WBUR's interim general manager, Sam Fleming.
She has incredible depth of experience in understanding the editorial ecosystem that we work in here and at NPR. She's also now been in the outside business world for 5 years, so she actually understands how that works and hasn't been in the bubble that is public radio her entire career.
We caught up with Margaret Lowe earlier today from Washington, D.C., and we started with why she wanted the job.
Oh, let me count the ways. I think it is the job of jobs. I actually grew up in Boston, just a few miles from the station. My parents were listeners and donors, and as I've said, they would be cavilling if they knew I were coming back to Boston, if they were still with us. And actually, Tom and Ray were my father's mechanics back in the day. So, and BUR has been in my life for many years. During my time at NPR, I was back and forth to BUR. I think WBUR is a jewel in the public radio crown. It is a beacon of excellence, both in Boston and beyond. You have a magnificent lineup of shows. You have a strong bench of reporters. Your regional and local coverage is excellent. There's almost nothing that's not appealing about joining the staff and leading the team.
How would you characterize your vision for the station coming in, Margaret?
It's a little dangerous to characterize a vision this early. Obviously, I want to come in, listen, and learn. I think at this moment in time, the challenge to local journalism, the challenge to journalism itself, both the economic pressures and the political pressures are intense. I think it's vital for WBUR to play an important role in both the civic life of Boston and the democracy overall. So the kind of reporting that we do, accountability reporting, investigative reporting, enterprise reporting, I think can distinguish BUR and inform its future. And to have WBUR and City Space play a central role in the life of Boston, I think is a huge and important piece of what the future will hold.
Margaret, let's talk about public radio and journalism for a few minutes. You spent more than three decades in public radio. I think you started as an overnight production assistant for Morning Edition, Go You, and you worked as a producer for All Things Considered. You ended your time at NPR as the senior vice president of news while you were there. Why is public radio important in today's media landscape, and how do you see WBUR's fit specifically in that landscape?
There is this deeply embedded role that public radio plays in people's lives. Like, you can read everything in the world, but there's something about the memories of driving in a car, listening to the radio, the intimacy of the medium is very, very powerful. And people, I mean, public radio, NPR and public radio and BUR have done something that other editorial or institutions are trying to do too, which is to make themselves vital in people's everyday lives, to have people love them and need them and want to come back again and again. In some ways, public radio is ahead of the game in terms of building a lasting relationship with its listeners, with its audiences. And I think that's what's so appealing about coming to BUR. And I also feel like, or believe that, as I said, like local journalism is under threat. And the chance for an institution to play a vital role in the city of Boston and beyond is not just an important opportunity, but I can't think of anything that would be more meaningful to do in this next chapter of my life.
Margaret, you talked about both the unique intimacy that public radio brings to its listeners as it brings news and information. You talked about the relationship between WBUR specifically and its listeners. This is a time when local journalism is under threat. Papers are being gutted. Interestingly, public radio has actually remained fairly strong. Because of that intimacy, is that kind of strength sustainable? And what can public radio do to fill a growing gap in local news that's being left by other forms of local journalism being gutted in today's market?
I think you're right, Tiziana, and I think that WBUR and that the news staff has both an opportunity and obligation to report deeply and seriously about what's happening in Boston and the wider region. And luckily for the station and for Boston, WBUR's economics, while you know, it's not an easy thing to constantly win the hearts and minds of our listeners and our readers and our users or however people find us. There's a kind of sturdiness to it. So now is the chance to really distinguish ourselves at every turn, to report stories that are going to make a difference in people's lives, to make sure that people feel like it's not just a vital service doing what everybody else is doing, but actually adding adding a powerful dimension to the way they live and understand the world that they live in.
It's an extraordinary time for journalism, especially here in the U.S. You know, we've seen the rise of fake news. We've actually seen the rise of fake news accusations about real news. There's sort of an increased anti-journalistic skepticism and sentiment. And at the same time, I think the media were arguably really taken off guard by the election of President Trump in 2016. So to the extent that it is possible to generalize, is journalism out of touch with what's happening in the country at some level? And if so, what do we do about it, especially when quality reporting is so essential to where we are right now and where we'll be as the 2020 presidential elections, come forward?
I think the obligation is to report vigorously and rigorously and to tell stories that need to be told and to report with a kind of attention to telling the stories of everybody who lives in Boston, and so that people hear themselves and feel themselves when they listen to WBUR and to the stories that we're reporting. It's not WBUR's role to change journalism across the country, but I think we can have a huge impact on what we do in Boston, and hopefully that will resonate.
Margaret, shifting gears, listeners know that WBUR has had some internal challenges over the last few years. WBUR's former station manager, Charlie Kravitz, stepped down last spring. That came after WBUR employees voted overwhelmingly to unionize. The year before, Tom Ashbrook, who had hosted On Point for 16 years, was dismissed after 11 current and former station employees accused him of misconduct, and university investigators did find that he had created an abusive work environment. I also have to point out WBUR isn't alone in this. NPR in D.C. dismissed a top executive, Michael Oreskes, for misconduct. WNYC dismissed two hosts over inappropriate behavior. Minnesota Public Radio had a similar case with Garrison Keillor, The wounds from all of that are still healing. We are in a healing stage in public radio. You're a new leader and a woman leader. How will you lead that healing?
Yeah, look, it's been a wrenching time. I know it was a wrenching time at WBUR, at NPR, and certainly at the other institutions you named. I think my job will be to be the people leader and the thought leader. And obviously the culture of an organization is paramount. And I believe that creating a sort of a healthy culture is the same as really making sure you're a healthy human being, or how you nurture healthy relationships or relationships that you cherish. You have to tend to it every day. It's not one and done. It's not like you figure out, okay, how do we solve the problems that we have and just make ourselves a good and healthy organization? And it's about listening and learning. It's about communication and collaboration and understanding what the pressure points are and actually sort of running towards it, not running away from it.
What do you mean by that, running towards it?
I mean actually understanding what is causing pain, what the real issues are that people are facing, how to rebuild the organization so that it feels healthy. I mean, I believe that BUR is a really strong institution, and in some ways what feel like impossible moments almost create an opportunity to get stronger, right? Like what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and you learn, you know, hopefully this is a learning moment for the institution and for all of us. And the other important thing is one can come in as a leader, and yet I won't be able to do it alone, right? This is a whole, we have to be a sort of united fighting force. And I love having fun at work, and I want the people around me to feel like, oh my God, this is the best place in the whole wide world to work. And it will take some time to get there, and it won't be perfect. And people are complex beings. And, but I actually feel enormous confidence in the possibilities at BUR and our ability to make it feel like it's regained its footing and is going strong.
You have ties to Boston. You talked about growing up in Belmont. What are you most looking forward to doing when you get here for your January start?
That's such a good question. I look forward to running on the Charles River. I look forward to re-meeting old friends and discovering new ones. I think Boston is probably one of the most exciting cities to be in the country right now. It's booming. There's just so much opportunity. And I know that there's great restaurants. I'm looking forward to just about everything.
And Margaret, what are you hoping to do in your first 100 days as general manager and CEO?
First, I want to get to know the staff. I want to listen deeply. And then I want to lay out a plan for where we're headed as quickly as possible and as long as it takes. I mean, it is I will walk in listening and learning. And I hope within the first 3 months to set WBUR on a course for the future that everybody feels invigorated by.
That is Margaret Lowe, the incoming general manager and CEO of WBUR. Margaret, welcome, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tiziana. Thank you.
Top Democrats say more hearings could be coming on the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. That's after a marathon week with 9 people testifying about the White House's dealings with Ukraine. So what have we learned so far and what happens next? Here to help us break it all down is Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, WBUR legal analyst, and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, thanks for being with us.
Always good to be here.
So tons to digest from the last 2 weeks, multiple days, wall-to-wall coverage of the public hearings. Now that you've had a couple of days to reflect, what most sticks out to you about what you heard in those public hearings?
Well, the consistency of the story. There are a couple of things. One is when the Republicans say there's no direct evidence, you know, the judge in me goes up in arms. There is direct evidence here. There are the statements that the president made in the July phone call. There's the statements that were overheard. But in addition, there is a web of – there's the conspiracy that Mueller found lacking. We have here. here and very explicitly the conspiracy of people who were implementing what the president wanted, which means that their statements can be taken against him. That's what happens.
So are you saying there's collusion this time around?
Yes, that's right. Although collusion is not a legal term, but in a conspiracy to, you know, distribute drugs, the guy who, at the direction of the leader, arranges for the transportation and gets the money, his statements count against the leader. In addition, you're always held responsible for the statements of your agent. Giuliani's statements are countable, are admissible against the president. There is a huge amount of evidence here, and the stories are actually, for the most part, totally consistent. And that's so interesting, because notwithstanding the different positions that people were in the embassy, in the national security apparatus, they nevertheless told a really perfectly consistent story.
And just to be very clear, what does constitute direct evidence?
The direct evidence would be, I can quote your statements now. You're in front of me. You are, I could cross-examine you if I wanted to. And your statements then comprise direct evidence of your state of mind. When you report to somebody else what your state of mind, and there's actually a theory of admissibility for that as well. When you tell your co-conspirators what's going on and they testify, that is arguably hearsay, but there's an exception for that. So a co-conspirator could testify. You tell your agent to do something, the agent's words can come in against you. If we didn't have the conspiracy laws and the agency laws, then essentially all the sort of drug kingpins would have walked away. But there's direct, and all of that is direct evidence. Circumstantial evidence is evidence where you know the underpinnings of the facts and the inferences are clear. And so, for example, at one point, Sondland said, I knew that the aid was cut off. I didn't know why. Nobody could give me an explanation. And it was going on at the same time at these discussions of, you know, if Zelensky doesn't announce investigations, he can't come to the White House.
This is Gordon Sondland, the EU ambassador. Right.
He drew an inference, which any reasonable jury or reasonable decision maker would draw, that the two were connected. There was no other explanation.
So it sounds like you might argue that there is sufficient evidence to file articles of impeachment in the House today.
I think that there is sufficient evidence. The analogy here is as if, you know, Mayor Walsh decided to withhold funding for the police unless they, you know, endorsed him in the next election.
Marty Walsh is not going to like that analogy today.
but it really is. It's the notion of playing around with security funds for an ally in the midst of a war, not for the purposes of ferreting out corruption, but for the purposes of enlisting Ukraine in the president's own personal political bandwagon.
So what about the argument, and there are supporters of the president who are clearly making this argument, that whether it happened or not does not mean that it rises to the category of an impeachable offense?
Well, you know, that is a political judgment, but you can only look at analogies. This is, unlike Clinton, for example, this is using the levers of power for your own personal end. I can't think of anything else that would, as Schiff said, if this is not impeachable, what is? What would, you know, if this isn't impeachable, what is?
All right. So you and I were talking before the show about the fact that we are imminently awaiting a judgment by a federal court about whether or not former White House counsel Don McGahn is required to appear after being called to testify. What's at stake there and why is it important?
Well, it is unheard of for a witness to ignore a lawful subpoena, totally ignore it. Typically what happens, in fact, I can't think of a situation where it didn't happen, is the witness comes to court to claim whatever privileges he or she has. The witness never fails to appear in court. This is really casting disrepute on the White House in a fundamental way. So what the judge is likely to say is, McGahn, you have to appear before Congress. You may have privilege issues that you will assert, conversations with the president that fit under executive privilege. You may have that, but you can't not appear.
So that would have implications then for other people like acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, for example,
right,
and others who have been subpoenaed and have literally just not walked into the hearing.
Right. I mean, Mulvaney and Bolton in particular, and Bolton is the interesting character here because Bolton carries with him the national security Republican establishment in a way that no one else does.
You what do you mean by that?
Well, you can't look at John Bolton and say this is a never-Trumper. If he testifies, his testimony will be on behalf of a very substantial part of the Republican Party.
And he's the former National Security Advisor and served under other Republican administrations,
right,
as
and,
well.
And he believes in a robust, I mean, one can disagree with what he believes in, but he certainly, you know, mirrors a certain portion of the Republican Party. Let me say also, by the way, that arguably things that the president says to his attorney, or arguably his attorney, may fit within a privilege, but the things that the president tells people to tell others is not ever privileged. So if, for example, President Trump tells McGahn, or better yet, tells Giuliani, tell Zelensky, the head of Ukraine, X or Y, that's never privileged because it's not confidential. It fits into the category of orders that were given. So they can provide direct evidence of the orders that were given by this president with respect to Ukraine.
Staying with the law for a minute longer, and then we'll do one or two things on the politics as well. Rudy Giuliani, you referred to him earlier in our conversation as the president's agent. Is there a level of legal exposure for him now that's become more urgent? There's some discussion about an interview he gave with CNN where he quipped about having insurance in case the president ran over him with a bus. Is he at risk now personally?
I think he's at substantial risk. He's already made it clear that in his activities in Ukraine, he was not acting as the president's lawyer, cover what he did in any event. You can't claim to be acting as someone's lawyer and then do things that are not lawyer-like and have nothing to do with a pending case, but is political. So no, he has enormous exposure for what he did at the president's behest, and then there is exposure for the ways in which he was wrapped up in what the two individuals who were recently indicted are also doing.
The Ukrainian businessmen.
The Ukrainian businessmen. Ukrainian-American they are. And he certainly, and we don't know the extent of that exposure. All I can say about that is the sloppiness of his language, if that mirrors the sloppiness of his acts, I would be very concerned were I his lawyer.
So you've pointed out today and other times that impeachment is a political process. It's not a legal process. So even if the House does file articles of impeachment, the Senate doesn't necessarily have to try the president. A new poll from the Hill shows that independents are souring on the inquiry. Is it politically a smart strategy to keep going?
I can't answer that because having lived through the Nixon impeachment, there certainly were souring moments during the course of that. And then all of a sudden, information comes out, which suddenly changes the equation completely. But really, apart from that, and maybe this is the judge in me, this conduct has to be announced as wrong. I understand the potential consequences, but it has to be announced as wrong, not just unpopular, but really wrong.
That's Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, WBUR legal analyst, and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, thanks for spending the time.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, Boston's Black Radical, the story of William Monroe Trotter and his newspaper, The Guardian. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. William Monroe Trotter was the co-founder and editor of the Boston-based black weekly newspaper, The Guardian. The Guardian was a powerful force in black journalism at the time. Through vocal advocacy for anti-lynching laws and enforcement of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, Trotter built a reputation as an uncompromising fighter working to prevent the rollback of Reconstruction. He was also rival to another significant black leader of the time, Booker T. Washington. Carrie Greenidge teaches history at Tufts University, where she's the director of the school's program in American Studies. She's also author of Black Radical, The Life and Times of William Monroe Trotter. It's the first major biography of Trotter since 1970. Carrie was in the studio with me last week, and I wanted to know why it was important to retell Trotter's story now.
So the last biography was written in the 1970s by a wonderful author named Stephen Fox, and he was coming from the turmoil of the 1960s. He was limited by the historical records that he had at the time. And since 1970, the field of African-American history in particular and American history generally has evolved, as we all know, and the access we now have to certain records that were not available in the 1960s are available for this book. The other thing I think is that Trotter's life really illustrates life at a time when there was a promise of the end of the Civil War and the promise of radical Reconstruction, and then that promise was betrayed with the fall of Reconstruction and the rise of the late 19th century, early 20th century shift. And so I think his life is relevant to our time because many people feel sort of we're in the same moment of sort of all this promise happening 60s, 70s, into the 80s. And then there's this moment where people feel as though the political times are in flux. So he definitely is a figure that is relevant for our times.
So let's talk about The Guardian a little bit. He did found it, I think, in 1901 with one of Boston's first black librarians, George Forbes.
Yes.
It was at kind of the vanguard of an explosion of black journalism and black press. Is that correct? And that's sort of what I took from the book. And how would you situate the role of The Guardian in that landscape?
So The Guardian is founded, as you're absolutely correct, in 1901. It's founded at a time when there's an explosion of black newspapers across the country. So The Guardian emerges amongst other known high-circulating newspapers. His paper was different in that he did not accept support from sponsors. And so what would typically happen, and this was true for the black press as well as the white press, was that political actors would support a newspaper and support that newspaper as a way to help get their political message across. Of course, this is before TV or anything like that. And so Trotter was big on saying that The Guardian was not going to be bought, that he would fund it himself.
He was pure in that way, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. That he wouldn't accept advertisements from skin bleaching, hair straightening companies. And so his paper really became this institution that emerged at a time when many other newspapers to survive were doing that. And he was fortunate enough to have his own fortune that went into the newspaper to support it without having to be dictated by political whim.
And it went into the newspaper by the end of his life. He had used his fortune up in publishing The Guardian.
Exactly. So he enters 1900, a fresh Harvard University graduate, first Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Harvard. And by the time he died in 1934, his fortune was completely depleted. He basically went from being a real estate investor as a profession in the late 1890s to giving up that business to devote his time to The Guardian. And The Guardian having not being a moneymaker. It was never something that was going to make him wealthy. But really, the newspaper and his passion for civil rights is what drove him to keep the paper going.
So the book, the you know, the first half of the title is Black Radical.
Yes.
It is not hard to figure out once you start reading the book why that's the title of your book. As a reader, I felt like what you were telling us was he was uncompromising.
Yes.
It's part of the reason he got buried in history because he made everybody mad
with
his lack of compromising. His relationship or lack thereof with Booker T. Washington was breathtaking.
Yes.
As a reader, I mean, he calls him the great traitor, the Benedict, this is a quote, the Benedict Arnold of the Negro race.
Yes.
So tell us about that relationship.
So Trotter's main criticism of Booker T. Washington was that, in the words of Du Bois, Washington was a leader of two races, not one, that Washington was called in this very particular position of having to, number one, solicit funding for Tuskegee Institute from white donors, very wealthy white donors. Number two, create an organization and a educational institution in the South at a time when there's lynching, racial violence, and backlash against emancipation. And three, Washington did that at a time when he's having his own family. He's currying favor with white donors, often whom were not very into black civil rights in terms of desegregation. And so Trotter's issue with Washington was that he felt that Washington compromised the race for his own personal gain. And he was somebody also who realized and pointed out the damaging way that Washington's rhetoric propagated and participated in the deterioration of rights since the end of Reconstruction. And so Trotter's criticism was that Washington was not fit to be seen as a leader of African Americans, and that he had basically, he calls him an imported boss, that he was basically somebody who was seen as a leader by white Americans, and that black Americans were suffering underneath some of the policies. And underserved by that. And so that was his main criticism with Washington.
All right, so in the little bit we're going to ask you to read, Booker T. Washington is speaking in Boston at the AME Zion Church.
Yes.
Trotter invites himself, to that event, forces his way in. It's a meeting of the National Negro Business League.
Yes.
And he wants to ask questions he was prevented from asking at other venues around the country,
yes,
where Washington has been as well. Is
yes.
that right?
Yes.
All right, so why don't you read for us a little bit?
Trotter shouted, "Put me out, arrest me," and Lewis ordered police to remove Martin from the church. When one Black League member condescendingly huffed, "Throw Trotter out the window," the crowd surged once again, this time booing even louder as a policeman approached Trotter and told him to quiet down. And so it was that the Harvard-educated real estate broker son of a Union Army veteran and federal appointee became a populist icon amongst Black Boston working people. The more the police tried to control the situation, the more applause Trotter received.
So this page really stood out for me as a reader as kind of a microcosm of the book, mm-hmm. in that it feels like you are advancing Trotter as somebody who's uncompromising, absolutely disruptive approach was necessary during a time of great compromise, lack of enforcement, and a narrative among white America, sometimes in collaboration with parts of Black America.
Yes.
That wanted to say that the life of Black Americans was acceptable when it wasn't.
Yes, exactly. That's a very accurate reading. And he was somebody who wanted to disrupt the narrative that African American people particularly had about themselves, which they'd been fed, which is that voting had failed, that African American people had made little progress in slavery, that if they were to make progress, really what they had to do was, you know, buckle down and work, and, you know, eventually white America will accept you. And Trotter's argument was that this was not the case. We have to see ourselves as political actors. We have to see ourselves as having the right to vote, even if we can't vote in the South because we are disenfranchised. We can vote in the North. And when we vote, use that for our own ends and not for any political party that wants to manipulate our vote. And so he was definitely a disruptor, is a great word. He was somebody who was constantly putting himself in places where the bureaucracy of activism at the time, he probably was not invited to be, and then would insert himself. And through that, really insert average people who had little connection to these arguments that are happening between organizations, get them to feel that the argument and the struggle was their own.
So I was watching the most recent Democratic debate, and one of the subjects that came up was sort of enfranchisement into the Democratic Party of Black voters.
Yes.
That really struck me in the context of having just read Black
yes.
Radical,
mm-hmm.
because one of the things that Trotter does is call both parties to task and
yes.
say, it seems he argued, Black Americans should not ally themselves with a party, but only with platforms that serve the needs of Black Americans regardless of the party.
Yes. So he was very much saying that African American voters needed to ally themselves to the party that best met their interests as working people, as people who were denied the franchise, as people who were struggling underneath Southern and national repressive laws. And so his argument was that neither party, as they existed during his lifetime, was good at preserving the rights of African Americans, but that when Black people voted, they had to vote in their best interests.
So there are a couple other things that I want to get
yes.
to before we finish. One, I felt like at some level for me as a reader, you were rewriting my understanding of Black history in Boston.
Yes.
Do people not fully understand the role of Black history in Boston and Boston's Black community in larger American history?
Absolutely. I remember when I started working on the book and I would tell other historians what I was doing, a lot of them reacted with the rhetoric that we know about Boston. You know, Boston was a place where there was abolition before the Civil War, and then we kind of learn a little bit that Martin Luther King Jr. went to school here, and then we learn about busing, and then there's not really
right.
a lot of other
three data points.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And really, the Black community in Boston is one of the oldest African-American, African-descended communities in the Americas. And despite the small numbers compared to cities like New York or cities like Philadelphia, the black community has always had an impact on the region's politics and has always had an impact on the way the region reacts and enacts racial policy and racial thought. And so I really wanted to examine what does black civil rights look like in a city like Boston, where many people don't consider that history is long and is as significant as it is. And I really, Trotter is somebody who was as much a part of the city of Boston as Boston was a part of him. And it's not to say that he's exceptional, the city is exceptional. It's to say what happens when we look at African-American history through the lens of a city or a region or a space that we don't traditionally think of looking at it.
Both Zoe, our producer, and I, when we were reflecting on the book, also reflected on what appears to be a man who was very much made possible by the women in his life.
Oh, yes.
But who did not give credit to those women, including his wife, Deanie, or
yes,
acknowledge the role that they played in making The Guardian possible, both practically and sort of politically.
Yes.
So how do we understand and reconcile that piece of him?
So I always preface this by saying that Trotter was a misogynist. There's no getting around it.
There you go.
He was somebody who grew up with his sisters actually being the favorite of his father, I argue in the book, and him being seen as you have to toughen up and be a man. And the consequence of that, in my estimation, is that he became somebody who was treated as the golden child, goes to Harvard and graduates and makes his parents proud, but also in that is seen as he does that alone, and that was definitely the narrative he was given his whole life. And so even though we know his mother is, you know, invests her husband when he dies, invests the family property in all of these properties and her three adult children and then her son's, you know, political escapades, both of his sisters basically for a time put their lives on hold to support the Guardian. His wife doesn't have any children and then puts her life on hold to support the Guardian. And it's through the women that he, as you're saying, that he's eventually allowed to pursue the career that he does pursue. He, throughout his life, had not a reckoning, but he began to, particularly after his wife passed away in 1918, had a different approach to black women in his life who continued to run the newspaper. And so he had a local black woman run the newspaper when he went to France, and she basically upped the numbers of subscriptions. And so it's really it's a relationship, I think, of a lesson of how a misogynistic sort of man who's a leader, brilliant politically, the relationships and the compromises that misogyny can make with the women in his life.
All right. So the last question, and this isn't a spoiler for readers because the beginning of the book starts at the end.
Yes.
So it's Trotter is 66 years old and he dies by suicide after jumping from the roof of a boarding house where he lives in Roxbury.
Yes.
It set up a question for me that I returned to as a reader all the way throughout the book.
Yes.
Which was, at the end of the day, did he succeed or didn't he?
He succeeded in the sense that telling and inspiring African American community to decide for themselves what their politics is going to be. He succeeded in that. He succeeded in radicalizing a whole generation of African American people. A. Philip Randolph is one. Cyril Briggs is another. Pan-Africanists in Boston are another. Galvanizing those people to see the possibilities of black radicalism in a way they hadn't before. So he did succeed. He, in terms of his life and the end of his life, he was a man in 1934 who was looking out at a country that was in the midst of the Great Depression. He was told that the Guardian was going to not survive, and that was his life work. He was told existed in a city that at the time, you know, one third of all Bostonians were out of work with no sense of relief in sight. And so he dies at a moment in his life where, if we look back, you know, many people were feeling this way in 1934, that, you know, the world was cutting to this cataclysmic end. So his contributions, I would say, in the consciousness, the way that he had African-American people and influenced them to think about themselves and their own possibilities.
And did The Guardian survive?
The Guardian continued to publish. His sister continued to publish it until her death in the 1950s. The Guardian itself faded, but the Bay State Banner, actually, in Boston, is kind of the child of the spirit of The Guardian, and that began in the 1960s.
That's Carrie Greenidge. She teaches history at Tufts University, and her new book is is Black Radical, The Life and Times of William Monroe Trotter. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, wild turkeys, neighborhood nuisance or conservation miracle. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Some see them as pests. Ben Franklin apparently found them majestic. However you feel about them, wild turkeys, which were once pushed to the brink of extinction, definitely now live among us. Joining me now to talk about all things turkey is Matt Miller. He's the Director of Science Communications for the Nature Conservancy. Matt, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so Matt, let's start by building up some of our esteem for the wild turkey. You say that it's actually one of the greatest conservation success stories. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, at the turn of the 20th century, in the early 1900s, wild turkeys were actually fewer in number than what African elephants or polar bears are today. And we consider those crisis situations. Conservationists spend a lot of time worrying about elephants and polar bears, and even consider it hopeless. Well, at one point, turkeys were just as hopeless, or so it seemed. But then they came roaring back due to a combination of hunting regulations and reforestation of parts of the country.
I think you got to say they came gobbling back, Matt.
They came gobbling back, and there were some failures along the way. But now we have turkeys coast to coast.
Okay, so what actually initially pushed them to extinction?
Well, it was unregulated hunting, largely. People hunted them for food and also for the market. And at the same time—
Wait, what do you mean for the market? You mean they hunted them for their own food and to sell into the food market?
Absolutely. Wild game was very common in the finest diners in New York City, in Boston, up and down the East Coast.
So then how low did their numbers go, and what did we do that really brought them back? There have been, countless species, right, who faced that tipping point of extinction and never came back.
Well, it's estimated in the early 1900s the population was down to maybe 15,000 birds across the continent. That's it.
Across the entire North American continent.
Across the entire North American continent. Most areas had no turkeys left. And at first, it was just simply regulations. So hunting became regulated. There was a demographic shift. You know, people were no longer dependent on hunting for their food. But there were regulations and they were enforced. Then they started breeding turkeys in captivity to reintroduce them. But that didn't work at all because turkeys domesticate pretty easily. So they release these turkeys and they couldn't adapt to the wild. But people thought, well, maybe turkeys' time have passed. They just can't adapt to humanity. Completely untrue. When they caught wild turkeys and reintroduced them, they took off across the country because they're very adaptable. They'll eat just about anything. They'll eat frogs. They'll eat your backyard bird seed. It's hard to imagine a more adaptable bird.
So in addition to there being just some demographic shifts, that there really wasn't any public policy intervention to that piece of it, there were restrictions on hunting, but it sounds like you're saying there was actually a relocation project that went on as well. It sounds like you're saying we captured wild turkeys in one place and relocated them somewhere else.
Yes, a colleague of mine calls it the Great Turkey Shuffle. Turkeys were moved.
That's awesome.
They were holding on in places like Michigan, and so then they moved them to Pennsylvania. And so they got established in Pennsylvania. They moved them to Massachusetts and so on. And so turkeys got moved around a lot, and they took to their new homes quite readily.
So I was at first encouraged that maybe this is a model that can be used for saving other endangered species. You raised the African elephant and the polar bear as two examples that are similar in their sort of level of threat. But if there were these demographic shifts that were part of what happened, is this a model that could be successfully used for other endangered species today?
Well, I think one of the overlooked factors in wildlife conservation is that we have to look at people and not just wildlife. And so It's not easy to live with elephants if you're living there. And frankly, it's not easy to live with turkeys if they're in the neighborhood.
I think people in our communities here would tell you it's not easy to live with turkeys now.
Yeah. So sometimes we just think of African elephants as living in the wilderness, but that's completely not true. And so we have to think about the human communities. And, you know, they aren't poaching elephants just because it's something to do. They're poaching it because oftentimes they need money. And so at one point, people were poaching turkeys because they needed money. So you can't overlook the human equation of wildlife conservation.
So, Matt, now that turkeys are back sort of in full force, why are they so good at living in places like Brookline or Newton, Cambridge, even parts of Boston or, frankly, my own backyard?
Well, they love a mix of habitats. And so anywhere where you have some trees, some fields, and some food, they're going to prosper. And suburbia or urban areas have the added benefit of their primary predators, humans, are missing. And so are a lot of the other things.
No, I'm there, Matt. They're in my backyard.
Yeah, well, human hunters, it's kind of tough to hunt a turkey in suburbia, and the turkeys know that. And, you know, it's mystifying to me that people will often refer to turkeys as being stupid, and they really are not stupid birds. They know where to go to be safe, and they know where to go for food. And that last part can really get them in trouble with people. Sometimes they even turn aggressive.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Last year, a pregnant woman in Cambridge was attacked by multiple turkeys. We've heard other stories about turkeys being very aggressive and attacking people. What is that about?
Yes, so turkeys have a pecking order. And you know, we refer to a pecking order, and it's very real for turkeys. So they have to establish dominance. And once they get used to humans, they basically consider humans part of their flock, and they want to put us in our place and show us that we aren't as important as we think we are. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is that people are feeding turkeys, and sometimes they think it's cool if a turkey's eating out of their hands. But a general rule is it's always bad to feed a large wild animal, especially one equipped with large, sharp spurs. Because then when you don't feed them, they're going to take out that aggression on you with very poor results.
So you're basically failing to comply with your place in the pecking order by not providing food when they expect you to.
Exactly. And they start to see anything conspicuous as a threat, which is why they often will attack a loud motorcycle, or they see the mail carrier pull up and they'll take out their aggression on those folks.
So when you do come across a family of wild turkeys, and it happens all the time, you know, what do you do? What is the appropriate wild turkey encounter behavior, Matt?
Well, a lot of state wildlife agencies will advise that you walk with a stick, and you just give them plenty of space.
They'll cross the street.
Don't try to get into it with a wild turkey. They're surprisingly strong. Those wings can fly, and they can also knock you over. And they also do have those spurs, which can do a bit of damage.
All right. So last year, the Boston Globe ran an essay called "Let's Eat the Brookline Turkeys," calling them the ultimately locally sourced protein. That was tongue in cheek. But is it time to reintroduce levels of hunting that don't exist right now?
Well, you know, hunting turkeys is a popular outdoor sport in many rural parts of the country. When you're talking suburban areas, there are obviously safety issues. However, it is being done with white-tailed deer in a lot of areas because the deer problem has just gotten so out of control. I think if turkeys continue attacking people, we'll probably see the same introduction for them.
All right. And what is the coolest fact that people may not know about turkeys on this Thanksgiving week?
Well, I think one of the great things is that if you do follow turkeys from afar, of course, you will see that they are very social creatures, and they do gobble up just about anything. And so if you watch them, they're going to be eating meat, eating birdseed, eating anything they can find.
So kind of like goats.
They are, I guess you could call them feathered goats.
There you go. That's Matt Miller, Director of Science Communications for the Nature Conservancy. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tisiana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.